Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Borough Market Podcast and Borough Talks, the summer series of panel discussions on the world of food and drink. In this episode, we're discussing the drinks revolution and the impact of dozens of small breweries and distilleries on London's vibrant and innovative cocktail scene. Angela Clutton chairs a panel of experts and asks what it takes to become a success in this rapidly shifting environment. And on the panel, Dave Broome, Glaswegian writer, broadcaster, lecturer and all-round expert on spirits and the art of distilling. Kat Felsted, a senior buyer at England's oldest wine and spirit merchant, Berry Brothers & Rudd, and the company's first ever female master of wine. Dan Tapper, food and drink writer and self-taught brewer. And Tony Conigliaro, internationally renowned drinks creator, founder of the Drink Factory Consultancy, and three acclaimed mould-breaking London bars, 69 Colebrook Row, Bar Termini, and Untitled. As always, the audience is made up of a mix of food and drink lovers and professionals, and I asked them why they'd come tonight.
First, support the Borough Market following what happened a month ago, and feeling a sense of supporting the community that exists in Borough Market, and the product, and the opportunities through all the conferences to learn more about the spirit industry.
I'm here to come and listen to Dave Broome and Tony Conigliaro, among others. I've been in the drinks industry for a little while, and I'm trying to start my own business. So,
are you looking for some advice?
I am indeed. And it's always fantastic to listen to Dave, especially talk about actually literally anything. So I'm pretty excited.
I'm a member of the Cookbook Club, and I got an email from Angela to say that we would really like to support the Borough Market, and obviously that's why we're here.
Well, we've attended these talks before. They've been really interesting, things we never would have had an interest in. We came and heard ideas, concepts, and it's been fun. And they have some good snacks and food, and it's fun to be at the Borough Market.
And we also have one of our son's friends, we're from New Orleans, and one of our son's friends has started up a small distillery of his own. And so when I saw this, I thought, oh, next time I talk to Edward, I'll be able to actually talk in an intelligent way.
Some of the panellists to ask what piece of advice they had for anyone wanting to get into the drinks business.
Tony, king of cocktails in London, can we talk about? Because Angela says that you run the best bars in town, so we have to believe her, don't we?
It's very kind of her.
What would you say to people? There are plenty of people in the audience here who want to be you, who want to create new cocktails in this fantastically diverse market that London is. What's one piece of advice that you have for them?
Try not to copy. I mean, let's really, really know every aspect of what you're doing of the trade, you know, and get out there and really work it. Because the more you know about the trade, the more you understand about the trade, the more you've learned about the spirits, the cocktails, the drinks, the people and the service, the more you can create something that is more unique, that describes what you want to do rather than what, you know, describing what someone else does.
Yeah. And imagination is key, isn't it?
I think it's just diligence. You know, I think imagination, you know, can be a big part of it, but if you're not imaginative, just be diligent to being aware of, you know, doing something that's true to you rather than, you know, something else.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
How important is it to you to be at Borough Market tonight?
Oh, it's fantastic. I love Borough. It's always been a part of my life since, like, I'm a Londoner born and bred, so we've always kind of, like, had an affinity down here, for sure.
And Are you a drinks person?
I am a bit of a drinks person, both in the imbibing of, but also the making of. I'm an amateur cocktail maker. Yeah. My husband and I have a little kind of mixology thing going on. So, yeah, I am very interested in the way that food and drink kind of come together.
And you said that you're a big fan of Tony's bars.
I am a big fan of Tony's bars. I am. When I read out the list of his bars, I was basically saying all the places I like to go drink. They are amazing bars because they're cool in very, very different ways. And I think that's a lot of what the guys are talking about today. It's about finding ideas, getting your ideas through, rather than just replicating what other people are doing. We are such a wonderful melting pot of influences and ideas that then bursts out in your creativity. And it was true for him in cocktails, but it's true in all across the drink sphere and also across the food sphere. We have so much going on here, and we're also really happy to look back into our heritage. So we take on things at the moment, we look ahead and we look back. The mix of all that is what makes it really exciting.
So Dave, a lot of people here in the audience here are here with some advice. They may be interested themselves in becoming distillers. What's one piece of advice you'd give to people to take home?
If you want to become a distiller, taste again. Go around and see as many people as you can, from big companies and small. Ask them questions. You know, how do you do it? Why do you do it? What are you doing? Then work out what they're not doing and begin to try and craft something that takes the best aspects of what they're doing but make it your own. But it takes a long time to actually work it out.
There was a lot of emphasis on, you called it shoe leather, getting out, doing the stuff, you know, making it by hand, doing your own social marketing, just basically not going through the machine.
You know, the market's becoming so much more diversified. Small-scale distillers are you know, financially viable, so you can do it, but it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work to cut through. It's entirely possible. You really have to believe in what you're doing. You have to have a business plan, and you do have to be able to go out and do that shoe leather and sit at bars and build up relationships. You know, it's as simple as that. Any successful salesman anywhere in the world has been to a bar and then gone back to that bar and gone back to that bar, not even necessarily sold anything, but just made the face known. And it takes a long time, but the good ones work out.
Dan Tapper.
I'd say embrace diversity. So one of the strengths of a small-scale producer is that they can really keep an eye on new trends and react to those trends, whereas kind of the bigger breweries historically have been very slow to react to kind of new trends. So, you know, get out there, get on social media, see what's happening, and try and answer to the needs of kind of craft beer fans. I'm a great believer in the kind of Oscar Wilde approach, which is kind of the definition of a cynic is somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. And, you know, I think great craft brewers are people who know the price of nothing and the value of everything. So they're not always, willing to put profit before quality. And I think that's really key if you want to stand out from the crowd.
Kate Howell, Director of Communications at Borough Market, reminded us what the market is all about after a very difficult month.
It's lovely to see so many of you on a wonderful British summer's evening. I hope you've all got your blankets. We've got plenty of food and drink and stimulating conversation that'll help keep you warm and fend off that rain. My usual introduction talks about hashtags and enjoying the food and drink, but it would be remiss of me not to mention what a difficult month it's been for everybody involved with Borough Market. Whilst first and foremost, our thoughts obviously remain with those directly affected by the events of June the 3rd, the market itself is a very resilient community. The traders are back doing what they do best, providing food and drink from around the world for London and providing that with a smile. So it's great to have so many people here this evening being part of that community. So thank you very much for coming. The ticket sales from this evening and all have gone towards our trader support fund. So your support is really very much appreciated by that trader community. If something can be taken from the last month, it is really an affirmation that what we do here really matters. Markets provide a focus for communities. They are places where people can come together. They are an international, in Borough's case, melting pot where people can come and share. They are places of hope, places where friendships and relationships are made. And that's very much in evidence this evening. So thank you for being part of that. That's the serious bit over. What you're here for is to hear from our amazing panel, who are here to talk about their expertise within the drinks scene within the UK today. You're going to have the opportunity later to sample some of the food and drink from our traders, some wines, and a very special cocktail that's been made for you. So enjoy that. There's plenty of time for questions afterwards. Do speak up. There'll be microphones roaming. But I'm going to leave you in the very capable hands of a very special lady this evening. Your moderator for this evening, Angela Clutton, Vice Chair of the Guild of Food Writers. But I'm going to say, most importantly, she might not say herself, Chair of Borough Market's very own cookbook club that I know many of you are members of this evening. Thank you very much, Angela, for chairing this. You're going to do a great job. We're going to continue the conversation online with a few hashtags, hashtag Borough Talk, which I'm obliged to say, but we're also running a special hashtag, Love Borough. So thank you very much for being here. Have a brilliant evening.
Thank you, Kate. Hi, everyone. As Kate said, my name is Angela. Welcome to the latest of the 2017 Borough Talks season. Tonight, we're here to talk all things drinks, spirits, wines, beers, cocktails, and we have a really stonking panel of experts and specialists right across that spectrum, and they're going to be giving you their insight, their opinions about what's happening in the UK drinks world at the moment, and also some practical tips about getting into it, whether a business or an individual. What we're going to do, first of all, is just introduce the panel, and then we're going to get stuck in. That's all going to take about 45 minutes for everyone to talk to you about their views and take on it all. And then as we go along, if you can store up your questions, so then at the end we're going to have a good 15-20 minutes or so, an opportunity for all of you to ask anything you want to know from our panel. So going to kick off to my left with Dave Broom, who is writer, broadcaster, lecturer, all-round expert on spirits and the art of distilling. He's written 12 books.
Yeah, I think so.
12 books.
Yeah. Some of them are very small, though.
Well, some of them are here as well, so they can judge for themselves.
The good ones are here.
Yeah, we've got Rum, Rum the Manual, and The World's Atlas of Whiskey, I think. Yeah. So two of Dave's brilliant books are here. Dave, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you started out working in the industry?
Yeah, I did a degree in English at Stirling Uni and then went to Edinburgh, and there weren't very many jobs for English graduates. I don't think much has changed, to be perfectly honest. And I was walking past a branch of Odbins, and there was a sign in the window saying help wanted, and I went in and I got the job. And I stayed with Odbins for 7 years. And then after that, I did WSET up to diploma, and then I ran a pub for a year. And I was writing about jazz and weird music and wanted to get into writing. And then a job came up at a weekly trade magazine called Off License News, which was, the offices were directly opposite here. So this was kind of my old manor. Welcome back. Yeah, it's great to be back. So I stayed there 7 years doing, it's a weekly magazine, so just writing about all aspects of the drinks trade, from bottled water to ardent spirits, but doing quite a lot of educational writing. And then decided to go freelance in 95. God, it was a long time ago. And worked in an Australian winery for a while because I was going to write about wine. I wanted to understand a bit about writing about wine. For the too many musicians telling me that I wasn't a musician, so how could I be a critic of their music? And so I figured, well, if I'm going to write about wine, at least I should learn how to use a hose, which is effectively what I did in Australia. And then came back and began specialising in spirits.
Okay.
As you do.
We'll look forward to more of that in a sec. We're just going to move down, introduce the rest of the guys. So we've got Katrina Felsted, who is a master of wine and the senior buyer for Berry Brothers and Rudd. Similarly, Katrina, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got started in the industry and maybe a little bit about your role at the moment?
Sure. So it's interesting. I'm going to echo Dave a little bit. So I studied languages at university, but equally found that there weren't any jobs for languages graduates when I left as well. I spent the first 4 years of my career actually working for a Spanish petrochemical company, nothing to do with wine. Decided that importing plastics and rubber was not really floating my boat, and I was getting into wine at the same time. Also went to Odbins, started on as a trainee manager at Odbins, and I ended up being a manager there for about 3 years before moving to Berry Brothers in 2007. I was Berry Brothers I've been there for 10 years now. For the first 6 years I was in the marketing department, and then 4 years ago I moved into buying. And I currently, well, in my time at Berry's, I've bought for all, from all of the New World regions, so everything outside of the classical regions of Europe. But now I specialise in buying for Spain, Portugal, Australia, and New Zealand. And Berry Brothers is not just the private customer side that you probably associate with it, Britain's oldest wine merchant, etc. We also have an agency and trade arm called Fields Morris & Verdin, FMV. And through FMV, we supply all sectors of the UK wine trade, from national accounts, big supermarkets, to people like Majestic Wine Society, right through to the on-trade in London, including a lot of the restaurants in Borough Market.
Brilliant. So, thank you very much, Katrina. So next we have Daniel Tapper. Daniel Tapper is award-winning food and drink writer. 2015, first book was Food Unwrapped, but that's not really what you're here for tonight. You're here for tonight because 3 years ago you started the Beak Brewery in Yorkshire. Do you want to tell us just a little flavour of that before we go?
Sure. I mean, I can't compete with Dave writing 12 books. But yeah, I studied sociology at university. I started making documentaries for Guardian Films about current affairs. And after that, I kind of fell into reporting about food issues. After doing about 8 years of that, I got kind of bored of and jealous of writing about people who are making food, and decided to start making beer myself on a homebrew basis at home. After about 4 years of doing that, I decided to take the leap, and I bought it's called a nano brewery. It makes about 300 bottles of beer at a time, and I started that in the Yorkshire Dales, which is where I'm from, and began delivering that by bus around Leeds and Manchester. Since then, it's kind of grown, and I now run, it's called a nomadic brewery, so I travel around the country making my beers on a kind of large scale. So I basically hoodwink large breweries into letting me to use their kits.
Nice.
Essentially.
Cool. Thank you very much, Daniel. Then last but definitely not least on the panel, we have Tony Cligliaro, who is internationally renowned award-winning drinks flavour expert, cocktail supremo. If I were to list Tony's bars, which I will, they're also my absolute favourite bars in London. 69 Colbert Row, Bar Termini, Untitled, all fabulous, fabulous places. Tony, just tell us a little bit about how you got started in the drinks industry.
I kind of started at the pot wash as a kid and did all that kind of thing and worked in pubs. So I was kind of very familiar with all that. Then ended up at art school and did that for many years, Wimbledon and Middlesex, and thoroughly enjoyed that until the real world hit me and then realised I had to have a job. Worked in the fashion industry, which I absolutely loathed. didn't make no sense at all. And then ended up kind of working for a friend of mine, cleaning glasses. Everyone thought I was completely nuts because the fashion industry was paying a lot more. But I loved it and carried on going. Was very fortunate to work with some absolutely incredible people like Dick Bradsall and, Bruno Lubay and just incredible kind of flavorists and chefs and bartenders and characters, and kind of stuck with it.
Yeah, and it's going all right, yeah. Brilliant, all right, well, thank you very much, guys, for introducing yourselves so well. We're just gonna go through now and have a little chat with you all, and do feel free to kind of chip in as we go through, but we're gonna give you each your moments, talk about your particular realm. So Dave, we're gonna start with you, talking about the world of spirits.
Okay.
Do you want to talk a little bit about innovations, what's happening in the world of spirits at the moment?
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been such a good time for spirits. Uh-huh. There's never been such a vast array of spirits which are available to you, the wonderful public. We are, I think, genuinely in a bit of a golden age. There are new distilleries opening up. There's new ventures and new questions being asked about what to distill and how to distill and how to... whereas I was talking to Kat earlier, whereas kind of wine and spirits used to be very, very separate from each other, you wouldn't sort of cross-fertilise between it. I think there's an awful lot more of that taking place. So there's a lot of new whiskey distillers, for example, who've come out of brewing. So they're using a lot of brewing techniques and different yeasts, etc., in making whiskey. Yep. So that's an element of innovation as well. The whole idea of flavour, I think people are now just thinking in terms of just making a brand, they're actually really fascinated by the science of flavour. So
what do you think?
I think there's an amazing, amazing innovations going on at the moment.
Do you think anything particularly kick-started that golden age?
I think a lot of it came from America. It actually came from the craft brewing industry, okay. I think. and the fact that, you know, small-scale distilling, small-scale brewing was possible, and then these guys kept asking questions, and licenses became easier to obtain.
Yeah.
That then started over here. And I think then just generally around the world, people went, well, why can't we do it? You know, I think it was the idea that you could only make whiskey, for example, in the classic areas, yeah. or you could only make gin in classic areas. It's now going, well, why not? Why can't you make whiskey anywhere in the world?
I think that's going to be a theme tonight, isn't it? That it's easier for people now to kind of go, do you know what? We're just going to kind of, you know, do this.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think the information is out there. The knowledge is out there, so there is no excuse to make bad spirits. Unfortunately, people do make bad spirits, but there's no excuse not to make bad spirits, just like there's no excuse not to make good wine. You know, the techniques are there. So, yeah, I do think we're at a very, very interesting point in the history of spirits.
Yeah.
And I think from a consumer point of view, I think it's not just, oh, my goodness, you know, they're strong. Yes, we all know they're strong, but it's kind of, oh, thou shalt not touch because, you know, they're a bit too strong and it's, you know, it's not the appropriate thing to have. I think people are treating them in a much more sensible way and actually including spirits, whether it's through cocktails or whatever, in their lives. My dad was a whiskey drinker. You know, he would have one dram of whiskey when he came home every night, but we never drank wine. But I think today's consumer will be saying, well, actually, I will have a gin, but tomorrow night I might have a glass of this, or the night after I might have a glass of beer. So I think there's a greater scope and a greater willingness to try, and that helps as well.
And is there much cross-connection between different aspects of spirits of people who are, I suppose I mean, the people who are starting to kind of do more interesting and newer spirits? Is it quite a community of producers, or people work quite individually?
No, I think there is a genuine community building up, and it's very, very interesting to see that, you know, this dreadful word craft that keeps getting bandied about. You
we're
know,
going to come to that. Yeah, but we should come to
you know, but which I don't know what your opinion of it is. It was certainly in spirits world, everybody's kind of like about that, because how can you not say that somebody like Desmond Payne making gin for 60 years is not a craftsman? But I think, you know, the big guys are genuinely willing to help, and not just as paid consultants, but actually you know, to say, well, we have expertise of hundreds of years. So, come and learn, and we will help you and we will teach you. So there always has been a very, from a production side, you know, marketing-wise, everybody hates each other. But from a production point of view, there's always been this very, very tight and close community, you know, because in Scotland, for example, you know, if you're in a distillery and a piece of your kit breaks down, you're going to borrow it from the next distillery down the road, and there might be a relative or whatever. So I think on the production side, there's a genuine community. And
which makes it more exciting, I guess.
Well, it does. I mean, for example, in Japan, I do a lot of work in Japan, and the Japanese distillers did not talk to each other until pretty much the year 2001, when we got all the distillers up on stage. And that was the first time a lot of them had even met each other. Now they are actively collaborating with each other. So I think things are really changing. Yeah.
Dave, I also wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the world of writing about spirits and how you feel about breaking through in that, and what helps build a really good spirits writer, drinks writer more generally as well, but spirits.
Ask why. You know, you just continually ask why. You know, I've been doing it a long time, but I learn something new every day. You know, I learn something new with every glass I pick up. And I learn something new every time I meet somebody like Jim Beveridge at Johnny Walker. Or, you know, I live in Brighton, and a guy got in touch with me, and he's making gin in his garage in Shoreham. And I went along and saw him, and he's really, really good at what he's doing. And I learned a huge amount from him. Yeah. So you've got to be humble. But also, I think you've got to serve your apprenticeship. You know, you've got to do the hard work. You've got to go to the hard yards. And just because you can operate a computer doesn't mean you're an expert.
You can't wake up in the morning and just go, I'm going to.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the problems with problems with the media. If you sound like a bishop and Father Ted, but you know, everybody wants things so quickly that people assume that they know something just because they've managed to write a paragraph, and their opinion matters. And opinion is a great thing. You know, I'm an opinionated guy. But actually, knowledge is much, much deeper and much greater and much more important to pass on that knowledge and pass it on in a humble way.
I think
because that's what a writer's job is. A writer's job isn't to be you know, to force the issue and just say, this is what I think, is actually to be there passing on that information to the consumer.
I think this is probably the best advice I've ever heard for anyone who wants to be a food or drink writer. I just think you've just absolutely just nailed it about what it is to really kind of be good at doing writing in either one of those spheres. That's fantastic. Just going to move on now. But thank you so much, Dave. Because you brought up the brilliant word craft, I'm going to leap, if you don't mind, Kat, I'm going to leap down to Daniel, because it seems like a nice little segue there. So, Dan, what is craft beer?
Such a hard question to answer. I think we all loathe the term craft beer in some kind of way. And I think that's because craft beer doesn't really exist as a concept in the UK. So in the US, if you go there, if you make a beer and you call it craft, you have to be certified to call it craft beer. So a brewery has to make under, I think it's 200,000 hectolitres, and it has to be independent to call their beer craft. If you come to the UK, the sort of problem we have now is you have kind of multinational brands that are kind of masquerading as craft beer producers. Yeah. So they kind of, they have all the marketing and they look hip.
It's a label they can put on it.
And everything else, and it's a label. So the crazy thing is it's completely lawful to do that. So you can sell something as craft beer that hasn't been made in a genuinely craft-like
way. So what does that mean for you? You're saying it's made in a genuinely craft way. What do you mean?
So I don't know if anybody read The Guardian today, but there is a really interesting piece that the Society of Independent Brewers are so worried by this at the moment that they're actually planning on creating some kind of certification that proves that UK brewers are craft. And that kind of begs the question, what is a craft brewer? In their eyes, a craft brewer is small and it's independent. But I would actually take it one step further than that. I mean, for me, a craft brewer is... It's a brewery that has kind of authenticity and it doesn't compromise. And also they're kind of not prepared to put profit before quality. And you can't really quantify that in any kind of way. But probably one way of illustrating that is quite recently, for example, there's a group of wine bars called Vinoteca. And they commissioned me to make a wine barrel aged beer for them. And I was like, okay, that's absolutely fine. And the amount of effort that's gone into creating this beer is just ridiculous. I mean, the winemaker's just driven over in a Renault Clio with this one barrel all the way from Bordeaux to the centre of London. It's taking us 6 months to age this beer, and in the end we'll end up with 500 bottles of beer that we will probably lose money on that beer. And I'm not saying that craft breweries should lose money, that's ridiculous, but they should be committed to making certain beers within
their portfolio. The sound of craft beer bottles just being...
Yeah, exactly. So they should be sort of committed to making certain beers that, you know, don't make money and that puts kind of quality and provenance before profit.
Yeah. And do you think those then are the things that good craft brewers would have in common?
Yeah, so, I mean, we live in a really, really diverse market in terms of craft beer at the moment, but there's quite a nerdy app. I don't know if anyone uses it. It's called Untappd. And a lot of my kind of beer nerd friends use it, and they rate their favorite beers and breweries. And if you actually look at that, the top 10 most popular breweries in the UK all have three things in common. And the first thing is that they're really adept at making really hoppy but balanced pale ales. Now, that sounds boring, but that's kind of the bread and butter of the UK brewing industry. So you have to be really, really bloody good, basically, at making hoppy pale ales, and that's your bread and butter. Secondly, they're really good at interacting with customers. So they don't sort of shut themselves away in the brewery and just stick their beer out there and hope for the best. They're on social media, like checking out what the latest trends are. They're interacting with their customers and kind of spreading the word and the story of their brewery. And third, this may kind of sound like a really minor detail, but a lot of the top breweries now have tap rooms, so basically breweries on site. And that may sound boring, but it's a really great way of making really good profit margins and sort of connecting with your customers and making your brewery a destination.
And do you have that at Beak?
Sadly not, because
I don't. Bad now for asking.
Well, no, I don't have so I've gone a slightly different format where I don't have a bricks and mortar brewery.
Okay.
Instead, I kind of travel around sort of making my brews with different breweries.
Just before we move on, Dan, do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the beers that you do?
Yeah, sure. Well, moving back onto this idea of kind of genuinely craft beer being ridiculous and not making very much money. Yeah. Some of my favourite beers are those that I've been barrel aging. So recently I've been working with, does anybody know Northern Monk in Leeds? They're a really, really great craft brewery. I work quite closely with them, and I've basically got hold of a barrel from the Bolney Estate in Sussex, and have been aging an Imperial Porter in that for the last year. So that's coming out really interesting. And we also spent a good amount of summer foraging for raspberries around the outskirts of Leeds, and we've been aging a sour beer in over those foraged raspberries.
Wow, wow. Yeah. Oh, amazing. And am I right in saying, Dan, that your beers are developed partly to go with food, a very kind of food-focused...
Yeah, so, I mean, it's genuinely, like, I don't know if anyone's planning on setting up a brewery, but we live in really terrifying times to be a brewer. So there's more breweries per capita now than anywhere else on Earth.
Wow.
And yet only 20% of people drink craft beer. So right. I think as a craft brewer now, you have to find a way of sort of setting yourself out from the crowd.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The way that I've done that is used my experience as a food writer to kind of create beers that work particularly well with specific dishes.
Yeah, interesting. I'm just going to move on now then to Catriona, because I think that's a nice kind of thing for you to kind of link in with the partnering with the food, but also with the kind of craft aspect. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about how wine is mirroring some of these developments that the other guys have been talking about so far?
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting because in wine you definitely see in certain regions, certain producers, a movement towards... Actually, one of the keywords in wine, rather than craft, random, is more artisan. That's the wine term. So South Africa, particularly Australia now, are moving much more towards this feeling of what we call minimal intervention winemaking. So effectively, what I always find is slightly amusing about this is this is going back to the way wine was made, you know, centuries ago. Basically, wine, the best wines are made in the vineyard, is the phrase. If you've got the right grapes, if you grow them in the right way, and they are perfect when you harvest them, then when they're in the winery, the best thing you can do is to stand back and do nothing. But it's quite difficult because winemakers obviously study long and hard about all of the techniques and the scientific things you can do to make wine. And in certain areas, like Australia, for example, it's all been about the technical side of winemaking. And there, they're coming around now to the fact that actually we should stand back and look at more natural way that wine is made. And they're getting a lot, much better results from it. So it's very similar theme.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you want to tell us a little about the UK market at the moment and the challenges and sort of what's kind of going on?
It's quite interesting at the moment in the UK market. Lots of things to talk about. Firstly, we find that the UK wine market is becoming increasingly polarised. So you've got on one side the supermarket big brands. That's where the mass volume is. Average spend on a bottle of wine in the UK is £5.40. So actually these days, you know, when I was at university, that probably got you a sort of semi-decent bottle of wine. Now, you don't get an awful lot of wine in your bottle for £5.40 when you think about the duty and tax involved. Obviously, I don't want to mention the Brexit term, but we...
It's hard not to, though, isn't it, when you're talking about the UK market?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's mainly exchange rates. Since last June, the exchange rates have gone crazy. Yeah. So you are now spending more on your bottles of wine as well. So you've got that side of the market, the supermarkets, the mass volume. On the other side, though, we're seeing an increasing interest in the sector that my company deals more in, which is the £10 plus a bottle sector.
Yeah.
A lot more people are being more focused on quality now and provenance. It's definitely an increasing trend. People want to understand more about where the wine comes from and what the story is and who the winemaker is and what his dog's called and when it rained last year. This is the kind of, it's the story behind wine that makes it really interesting, for me certainly, and I think for most people.
And do you think that for producers as well, it's the focus for them to kind of find those stories to help them kind of get a presence and try and get their... Yeah. Get above the parapet.
Certainly when you come to the quality-focused producers, and particularly the more premium... most of them have their own stories naturally. That's why they're already famous.
Yeah.
But they certainly... There's a big focus on trying to learn to stand back. So, and it's quite hard to stand back and do nothing in the winery because it's your life... You know, your whole year is based on that moment when you pick those grapes that you've been tending throughout all the seasons, through rain and shine... And they're in the winery, and suddenly that's the time when that vintage, you're going to either make or break it, depending on what you do or what you don't do in the winery. There's a very famous South African producer called Eben Sardi, who is at the forefront of the new wave South African producers. And he said he spent about 10 years when he started up on his own before he realized that actually he'd been doing it all wrong because he'd been doing his winemaking, and after 10 years he said, I realized I needed to learn to leave things alone. I needed to learn to make myself stand back. And at that point, his wines transformed and are now what they are today.
Which That's amazing. Phenomenal. When we were doing the introductions, it was really interesting that each one of you, when you were saying how you got started in your respective industries, the answer was basically get stuck in and do it.
Yeah.
And but Katrina, I wondered if you could just talk for us a little bit about ways that people might be able to kind of think about getting into the wine industry and the different things that might mean, I suppose.
Sure. There's a few ways. I mean, the main thing I would say, if you're interested in getting into the wine trade, is to... start learning a bit about wine. So the WSET courses, that's the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, they're kind of the sort of fairly standard benchmark of a route through to learning about wine. You can study at home on those or do your courses at the actual WSET. But it's more finding out yourself and what interests you and exploring that. For me, wine is always a real... adventure, and every wine tastes different, and the beauty of wine is that there is no right or wrong answer. It's all subjective and everyone's opinion matters, so never be afraid of having an opinion. One way for me to get into the wine trade, what I would always recommend everybody, is don't be afraid of the shop floor. When I started, I started at Odbins.
Yeah.
It's a classic route into wine and spirits. Odbins or Majestic. I will say Odbins because that's where my loyalties lie.
Of course.
But you know, it's the best thing I ever did. I spent 4 years at the Spanish petrochemical company, umming and ahhing about how to get into wine, and then I was a bit snooty about whether I wanted to work on a shop floor. And as soon as I did, I was like, why didn't I do this 3 years ago? It's the people you meet, your colleagues, the customers, the conversations you have, the wines you taste. I would recommend that to anybody.
Yeah. I woefully neglected to say at the very beginning when I was introducing Katrina that not only is she a master of wine, but she is Brothers and Rudd's very first female master of wine.
Yeah.
And when we were planning for this, we were thinking a little bit about women in wine and the profile of the masters of wine and women. Yeah. Do you want to just touch on that?
Of course. I think there's definitely a perception, certainly historically, that the wine trade was very male-orientated. In my experience, it was, but that's certainly rapidly changing. So at the moment, there are 355 masters of wine in the world. and a third of them are women now, which is brilliant. And in 2014 and 2015, that more women in each of those years passed than men. So there's no reason to be afraid if you're a woman about getting into the wine trade. It's very much an open playing field now. Yeah. And I do quite a few events in our cellars at Bury Brothers, and I'd say over half of our customers that come in are women, and have very good, very valid opinions, really interested in wine, like I am.
Actually, can I get all of you, sorry, let that go, each of your kind of thoughts on that maybe about the kind of, you know, women working in the industries, maybe, you know, Dan, particularly thinking about brewing, maybe I'm wrong to say that I perceive that as being quite a male industry.
No, I mean, it's completely a female industry traditionally. So the thing is, hops are female, yeast is generally female.
Right.
Traditionally, females were always brewing beer, and the men were kind of serving the beer in the pubs, public houses, in people's homes. So actually, traditionally, beer is an industry dominated by women. And for some reason, I'm not a beer historian, but obviously over the last 200 years, women have been slowly pushed out of the industry. But there's a massive renaissance going on now, and like some of the best brewers in the country are female. Jen Merrick, she won last year Brewer of the Year. Ilkley Brewery has a head female brewer,
right,
and
they're genuinely
creating some of the most exciting beers at the moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely a really female friendly industry.
That's interesting. Tony, I'm going to come on to you now. I'm going to ask you to come back to that question, actually, once you've kind of done your initial thing. And I wanted to leave you till everyone else has spoken, because in a way, I suppose I think of cocktails as being something which brings all of these worlds together. And I think of you as being the most phenomenally creative person. And I'm really interested to hear your take on how the creative and the business aspects marry together.
Well, I suppose when you first start being creative, you just go nuts completely, and everything needs to come out, and it all tries to come out at once, and you don't know how to... It's like unleashing wild horses.
Yeah.
And then I suppose over a period of time, you realise that that's not the most efficient way to work on a creative level or within a business.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're always experimenting, experiments have a cost.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get a piece of machinery that will allow you to experiment with certain things, that has a cost. So, you know, over the years, I think it's a question of creating a balance between the two.
Yeah.
You know, having what a very wise friend of mine turned around to me and said, he goes, to create chaos, you need a lot of order.
That's good.
You know, and it's completely true. And as far as, you know, the more ordered our company has become, Drink Factory has become, the more chaos we've been able to create.
Yeah.
Just because, even on a really basic level, kind of like of recipes, you know, when we first used to do recipes, we used to just, you know, do them.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. And then everyone would say, well, how did we just do that? And everyone went, oh, I can't
just
remember.
Did it, yeah.
But nowadays we have, you know, files and files and files and files of recipes from, you know, the first idea of, or the concept, to how that led to the flavors, to how that kind of, you know, the first permutation of how those flavors came together, to, you know, the second, third, fourth, fifth, up until the 40th, 50th, whatever it might be. But at any one point, we can go back and see, oh, that went wrong. We can go back a step and do that. And that has made our lives so much easier.
Yeah.
Because I remember there's one particular combination from about, I don't know, 15 years ago that I'm still searching for that I cannot find.
Oh, no. It'd be great when you do find it.
Yeah, though. No, it'll be exciting. I'll let you know. But, you know, I think it's very important, but also kind of, you know, to have that order within a business allows you to kind of actually present what you do in a far better way.
Yeah.
You know, from presenting the cocktails to actually kind of having things on time.
Yeah.
You know, and how they're presented, the training done, the you know, all the elements that come together to create a list that's very strong, that goes out and is ready to be received in a you know, in a particular way. You know, you have the answers to ping pong backwards forward with the customer.
So sticking with that creative fundamental part of it, can you talk to us a little bit about the process that you go through when you're creating a new drink? Or that you and your team go through, maybe?
It's the team.
Yeah.
It always is. I think, you know,
Actually, we should probably go back a step because I'm not sure that everyone will know the Drink Factory and how that fits into the bars and how the whole thing connects.
Okay. So Drink Factory started out as a blog because I realised at a certain point that I didn't want to just be talking or making the same drinks over and over again forever. So I was desperate to communicate with other people, but wasn't really quite sure how to do it that well. So I started the blog, and that was really interesting. That was about, God knows how many years ago now. 2004. And I just kept kind of writing stuff that interested me. And slowly but surely that kind of got hooks in different places that I wasn't expecting, from perfumers to designers to kind of neurosurgeons to like the oddest type of people that just so happened to have an interest in booze as well as, you know, whatever they did. I, in my kitchen, had started borrowing equipment. So I had a rotavapor, which is a vacuum distillation unit. So I started doing experiments at home. I had a centrifuge that I'd borrowed, baked and stolen eventually. And, you know, and that was the first Drink Factory. So it was kind of, for me to make ingredients that were bespoke to my cocktails rather than having to go outside and buy them. Because one of the things I had a problem with was, especially in that period, was I couldn't find the ingredients that I wanted that were good enough for the drinks I wanted to make. So I started that. That kind of spread more to when we opened up 69 Cobalt Road, because I had a garret space upstairs and I put all the machinery in there. We got some more machinery. We started working on that. So it was kind of making things upstairs and taking them downstairs, you know, at kind of almost a la minute. And then that progressed again, where we had a space where we started, you know, being more consolidated and concentrated, and then the products would be delivered back to the bars. Now it's now in its fifth generation. We've got a full, you know, research and development kitchen. The product is made by mainly by the young gentleman at the back there, Dimmy. I thought I'd embarrass him.
Hiya.
Hi, Dimmy. That's that.
So you have a team that work with you developing,
and then So the whole, we've got a whole production line that goes to all the different bars from a central point. Dimmy, Zoe and myself see every single stage of the production, so there's an eye on quality. When we come up with ideas, we usually come up with stories. So one of the drinks you're going to taste later on is called Snow. And the we call them dioramas because we literally draw them out. You know, we went to art school, so it's and Zoe, my head of research and development, also went to art school. So it's a really good way to communicate ideas. We visualize them. So the visual aspect of that was we wanted to capture the notion of a snowflake landing on your tongue, you know, when you're...
How brilliant.
Yeah. And so we just started working on that. We then look at the kind of flavors that will tell the story of that situation.
Yeah.
So we're kind of using flavour as a language to describe that situation. That drink took almost 2 years to make.
Because
we had one missing ingredient and we were driving ourselves mad.
Yeah.
But the whole team goes out and looks for things, thinks about it, mulls it over, comes back. We, you know, have brainstorming sessions. We try out new ideas. We then write the recipes down. We go back again until we crack it.
Yeah. What's lovely is that... Tony's books, both of them, 69 Colebrook and Drinks, both tell a lot of those stories as you go through. It's not just drinks recipes. You really kind of manage to convey a lot of the kind of stories that go with them as well.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it gives an extra dimension, but it also gives, I think, a level at which, as with the stories of beer, wine and spirits nowadays, you know, a kind of inverted story of you know, if everyone here knows what a snowflake tastes like. Hopefully. Well, you will later if you don't. Hopefully. But it gives an extra parameter to have a conversation about.
Yeah.
You know, what we're finding is people want something to talk about in bars, not necessarily their everyday work or lives or thing. And if you give them something else to talk about, then they have something else to talk about. And even if it's an emotion or a reaction to a drink in a particular way, it allows them to kind of start a different kind of communication.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what the whole drinks industry is, you know, the whole world's trying to do is to talk.
Tony, can I just get your opinion on the London cocktails scene, for want of a better word, because I absolutely hate saying that. And also, just to follow on from that, just what you think might be coming next for the kind of cocktails. Okay.
I think the London scene is probably the most diverse, the most interesting in the world. I think there are other scenes that are equally kind of as interesting, but not as diverse.
Okay, that's cool.
Just because you have so many different, you know, people from all over the world here working.
Yeah.
And or have worked, and you know, there's this residue and but also this resonance of people and what they bring to the table.
Yeah.
You know, and because it's one of those jobs that you can pretty much do all over the world, you know, people come here to get trained but then go back, you know, to you know, where they're from, or they stay here. Yeah. Or, you know, and there's a great deal of communication. Yeah. To and from, but also kind of within the time itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we're talking to ourselves and we're brainstorming, we're always talking about, you know, what do you bring, you
yeah.
know, what do you know about that we don't know about, what can we incorporate from, you know, for example, Bulgaria or wherever.
Yeah.
That we don't know about.
Yeah.
And make it part of our
yeah.
our language. And I think that's allows you to, I suppose, you know, have communication with more people. And because of that, I think some of the other scenes are more direct and more
yeah.
focused on what they do yeah. rather than
so the ideas and influences here. Kind of coming together.
Yeah.
More creative.
What opens it up and makes the yeah. scene a lot stronger. You've also yeah. got so many different styles of drinks. You've got, you know, the very classic, you've got the kind of hotel bars, you've got the kind of dive bars, you know, you've got the kind of more modern kind of thinking bars, you've got,
yeah.
you know, so on and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, look, these guys have all been expounding at you. So now we're going to throw it open to all of you with questions. Anything that you've been hoping somebody might touch upon but hasn't yet, you know, this is your opportunity to go for it and say it. And we'll try and open it a bit more amongst each other. And, you know, people will probably have a certain person they want to ask. But do, you know, guys, have your opinions and throw in as well, because you've all got so much to contribute and say. We do have a couple of microphones coming around. If you can try and wait for the microphone, that'd be great, because otherwise you ask a question and no one else can hear what it is. So do we have anybody with a good question? Or any question, in fact? Yes, okay, we have a gentleman there. Hiya. And if your question's actually for somebody in particular, do say.
It's probably for all of the panelists. They're all clearly very interested in quality of the various areas they're in. And I come from a very technical background, so I'm intrigued. Is there one technical piece of kit that is used in your industries
Ooh.
That you'd like to see eradicated in industry? And if so, why?
Dave, do you want to go first?
Oh, great. Thank you. a piece of kit that you
everyone else has got time to think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know. That's great. I'm stalling here. As far as distillation goes, chill filtering machines. They strip away mouthfeel. And there are ways to get around having clear spirit that isn't going to throw any cloudiness. And you can also just educate people that if you add water, it might go cloudy. But I think removing mouthfeel is a bit daft. So that's what I would get rid of.
Katrina?
Interesting question. I would say the problem is with this is that you have two sides of the wine world. So you do the mass market volume side, as much as they're not wines that I would choose to drink, are absolutely fundamental to the wine business as well. But if I wanted to go for that side, I would say there's something called the spinning cone that can be used in wine. And basically, you put it's kind of does what it says in the tin. It spins the wine around. It's one way to lower alcohol. Many different things it can be useful, but you can lower the alcohol because the wine spins so quickly that the component parts are split up, and then you put the wine back together, and then you have a slightly more reduced alcohol version. That doesn't use to completely take the alcohol out. There's something else you can do for that. But what it does mean is that the wine that you then get back has lost some, you know, its soul. To my mind, it might make it more appealing from a kind of mass market volume perspective if it's not, you know, half a degree off
alcohol.
It's a romantic
way of saying it's lost its soul.
It's lost its soul. So for me, I'd love to see the end of the spinning cone. But then the wine world, the volume brands would disagree with me. None of them will admit to using it, though.
So you made a good argument, though, I think.
Yeah.
Tony, I'm going to go to you next, because I feel bad. You're always the last one to talk.
Technical. Bad cocktail books.
Are you going to name them?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
No, just because there are books like Dave Arnold's book, which is just one of the best books ever written about cocktails. It's just fascinating, interesting. But when people kind of take his theories and then regurgitate them and spin them around in a way that's not scientific, and just because it's an idea, I have a problem there.
Okay. There's a little bonfire of those. Yeah.
Dan? I think filtration units in brewing are the devil's work. So echoing Dave there. And I also think I'm dead against finings, which are the dried swim bladders of sturgeon fish that you get in the vast amount of cask beer. And I'd like to see that removed.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Save the sturgeon.
It's a
waste of sturgeon, you know, I think.
Well, I think you all put forward very convincing arguments for that. Great question.
That's a great question.
Has anyone actually got a microphone? Or there's a lady down here at the front.
I was just wondering, I guess along those lines, you've all been talking about kind of small-scale producers and artisan or craft drinks being kind of the main focus at the moment. And so I just wondered, if there's always kind of a new big thing, if the sort of small-scale producers are finding that the best quality is minimal intervention, then in a way, where can they go from there? Or will people be happy to kind of keep things, you know, keep natural and kind of small-scale producers being the kind of next big thing forever?
You were looking at Katrona as you spoke, so I'm going to take that as being the cue for the first.
Yeah, sure. I hope so. I hope it continue. I hope it lasts. I think the wine world has swung in various different ways, particularly the New World, when it was all very much led by science, compared to Europe, which, you know, they've been making wine for centuries, so that was kind of, they always did the way they'd always done them. The very scientific side for kind of New World wines had its place, certainly, and they are, you know, so technically adept. They're the, you know, the best in the world. But the minimum intervention, it's almost an art in itself. You've got to stand back, and as I said with that quote from Evan, you've got to stand back and know when to get involved and when to leave the wine alone. And for me, it's about quality. And quality is definitely, from all the wines that you taste, the wines that where you've got a producer that is so in tune with the vineyard that he's been able to grow the grapes to perfection and then stand back in the winery and just let the wine make itself to a certain degree. Those just are the wines that have the most interest. They've got the most, there's a term in wine called terroir, which is the fact that a wine can taste, there's a sense of the place in which that the grapes were grown in the wine. And that's what comes through in the minimal intervention. So I would imagine that will continue. It's almost like people going back to the roots of wine.
Yeah. Dave, do you want to throw something?
It's a very interesting question at the moment within spirits. And I think it kind of comes back a little bit to something I was saying earlier, which is, you know, the guys who make Johnnie Walker are as passionate about their craft and quality as the person who's only got a tiny little distillery down the road. I think that's really important. That's an important emphasis to make. And I think what I've come across with a lot of the smaller distillers is they're great enthusiasts, you know, and they really want to do something and want to make something different, but they're not business people. And I think you have to understand this is a business and you've got to do the boring stuff like distribution and sales and, you know, how are you actually going to sell this? And also ask yourself some very, very hard questions about how do you differentiate yourself against the rest of the market? Because if you look at whiskey, and I'll can look at whiskey and gin very quickly here.
Yeah.
There's 119 whiskey distilleries in Scotland. If you're opening a new one, that's who you're fighting against. So you have to do something which is going to cut through. But it can't be contrived. It has to be genuine. So looking at the local, looking at what grows around you, taking beer techniques, there's various ways that you can do this, but I'm not convinced that everyone is necessarily doing it. They're kind of just doing what everybody else has done for many years, and they won't cut through. And the same with gin. A lot of gin, of the new gin distillers, simply say, well, all I need to do is add a different botanical, and nobody's ever added it before, and that's going to make my gin different. And they dial up so much that the gin's unbalanced. Gin is a much, much harder spirit to make than whiskey is. And I think a lot of the gin distillers have perhaps become croppers as a result of that. So it's coming back to learning, and there's a great future for small producers, but it's a business, and you've really got to cut through, and you can't be contrived, and you have to have the courage to say, no, that didn't work. And actually, the glorious thing about spirits is, redistill it if necessary, but don't put out anything onto the market that isn't any good, because eventually people will realise that paying 50 quid for a bottle, which isn't actually of great quality, you know.
Yeah,
I think you'll be rumbled.
Just to add to what Dave just said, I think there needs to be a brutal honesty with yourself if you're going to do it. Is it coming from the right place? Is it, you know, are you doing it for marketing, or are you doing it for the love of the spirit?
Yeah.
You know, because the whole thing with the gin is so true that it's another gin with another thing. But, you know, the ones that really, really shine through and are excellent are the ones that come from a really genuine place and love of what they do.
Yeah.
And as you said, the wine is the business side is really important, because obviously it's very good to talk about minimal intervention like you have, which sounds very romantic. But you need a certain amount of financial capital to stand back and let your wine ferment as long as it wants and stay in the barrels for as long as it wants. A lot of, you know, wineries don't have the luxury of that, because they need to turn the wine around, ferment it, make it, sell it, and clear the cellars in time for the following vintage to come in the next year. So there's all sorts of constraints. It's the ideal if you're a premium producer who has got to that level where you can afford financially to sit back and watch it. So it's quite a complex
issue. Yeah, people are going to fall for the romance of it.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I'm a distiller, I'm a winemaker. And then, you know.
But as Dan says, the horrible it's very reality. Easy to not make money.
Yeah. We have a lady who's burst in with a question there, and we had one down here. So do you have a microphone? Do you want to go for it?
Yeah. So you've spoken a lot about creativity and innovation, which I think is fantastic. And there's obviously a lot of great upcoming brands all across London at the moment, and also across the world as well. Turning it back to the point you just raised about it's got to be viable as a business as well. What way do you think is the best to approach sales and marketing for the upstart brands when they're trying to break into a new space, other than perhaps going through wholesalers, which is perhaps more for established brands to start with?
Catherine, I'm going to come to you, because I know your background at Berry Brothers and Rudd was initially marketing. Yeah?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think if you're a small producer, certainly when up and coming, I do think you need to be really switched on for social media these days, because whereas in the past you didn't really have a direct interaction with your consumer, you know, the person actually drinking your wine. If you're a small winery in Spain, someone in London is drinking a bottle of wine, you're never really going to meet. But now with social media, you have the option of having your story out there, so anybody drinking your wine can Google you, look at your website, look at your Twitter feed. And it's important to react, I think, to what people are saying, to be constantly on top of what people are talking about. I mean, that's the same for lots of businesses. Yeah. But I do think for an up-and-coming producer, that side of things has given them a direct access to the consumer that they've never had before.
I'm going to say that when I went on the Beat Brewery's website, I felt I knew in a second what your beers were and what you were there to do.
I mean, I was just going to add, can I just say, if you're thinking of setting up a food brand, just do not under any circumstances waste your money on marketing. That's my personal opinion. It costs a lot of money, and you just end up like somebody mimicking an authentic brand. I've lost count of the amount of small scale breweries that have just blown their breweries going to expensive marketing companies, and in the end their labels look crap. Their branding doesn't look authentic, and they just sort of, it becomes a kind of paint by numbers version of authenticity. And I think as we've touched on, social media is so important, because it's a kind of direct reflection of who you are as a person. And I know that sounds kind of cheesy, but I think at the end of the day, a real brand has to represent who you are as a person. And consumers aren't stupid. They see through glib marketing campaigns, and they recognize you know, brands that don't compromise.
Yeah, thank you. We have here available a few of the books from the panel if you'd like to go and take a look. We also have some of the Loveborough range of aprons and badges and things, and everybody would really appreciate any support you can give towards that, because everything goes towards the Traders Fund. We have some really lovely food and drink that Traders have supplied for us to all to enjoy tonight. And even more excitingly possibly than that, because it's a one-off, we have snow that Tony was talking about earlier being made over there. And I think if you want to head there first before going to everything else, that would be appreciated. So I'm going to leave you all to go and enjoy. Some of the panel, I think, are maybe going to stick around. So do nab them and ask anything you haven't had the chance to. But huge, huge thanks, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
The next Borough Talks is on September the 12th, when the panellists will explore the viability of less damaging systems of food production. You can get your tickets and subscribe to this podcast on the Borough Market website, boroughmarket.org.uk.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.